This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
It is design. It's a failure by design. It's the United States Senate. The Congress of the United States has ensured the failure of OSHA's whistleblower protection program.
Former federal OSHA whistleblower protection program lawyer and investigator Daryl Whitman on worker retaliation, health, and safety complaints.
Which has been repeatedly warned about how much more Medicare costs under private for-profit commercial insurance companies, and yet they have done absolutely nothing to stop this. Now the question I ask...
The effort to privatize Medicare has been taking place under both Republicans and Democrats. We'll hear from medical professionals who advocate for Medicare for all.
The thing that really jumps out at you is withholding the ballistics test that shows it wasn't Mr. Peltier's weapon. And that's the big thing. And if that happened today, the conviction rather is set aside.
And an interview with Kevin Sharp, attorney for U.S. political prisoner Leonard Peltier. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. April 28th is commemorated as Workers' Memorial Day around the world to remember those workers who have died on the job. Daryl Whitman was a lawyer and investigator with the Federal OSHA Whistleblower Protection Program in Region 9 in San Francisco. He investigated and made merit determinations of workers who made health and safety complaints and suffered retaliation. Companies such as FedEx, Wells Fargo, Morgan Stanley, and Amazon in some cases were ordered by his boss to falsify reports and drop the investigations. Whitman was fired by then Labor Secretary Tom Perez and has been organizing the cases of unprotected workers who were retaliated against.
But our purpose is to give people the actual evidence, which we're doing. These segments that are coming out were on B. A is out. It was a discussion of the audits, trying to explain what an audit is, why it's different from an investigation, what those audits that were done. There were five audits. There was a review by OSHA. There was another review by OSHA. Basically, these two reviews and five audits were done between 2008 and 2015. Basically, make the case themselves without anything else. You could, if you actually read this stuff and understood what was going on with these audits, it says this is a program that's failed. It's been a failure since 1988, at least. How could that be? It is completely dysfunctional? No. It is designed. It's a failure by design. It's the United States Senate. The Congress of the United States has ensured the failure of OSHA's whistleblower protection program. They've had multiple opportunities, you know, through the audits, particularly this 2008 audit, because it pointed out very specifically, oh, you know, the people who are running the program have no training to make it work. They're not keeping any records. They're not following the law. I mean, they basically describe a failed program, specifically. That's what audits do. They give you that information that says your car isn't working because the carburetor is broken. You know, it's a diagnostic tool. It's not the operation to fix it. It's a diagnostic tool. So the first diagnostic tool in 2008 basically laid out the whole thing. Oh, the whole program is a failure. And it's a known failure. It's been because they pointed back to the 1988 audit and said, you know, this stuff was going on in 20 years ago, and nobody has fixed it. And it's gotten worse and worse and worse. Do you know where that audit went? Who ordered that audit? The United States Senate. The Senator Patty Murray, who chairs the Senate Committee on Labor and oversees OSHA and the Department of Labor, her committee had requested the audit. She signed that audit, which described the program as a complete and utter failure. What did Senator Murray do? She ordered a second audit. not an investigation, an audit, to confirm what the first audit had said. So GAO does another audit right on top of the year after issuing that first audit, and they say, well, it's even worse than we thought. It's still going on. In spite of being told that these were the problems, OSHA itself had done nothing to fix them. So they tell that to Patty Murray and the committee, and what do? Nothing, nothing at all. And then you start getting the audits from the Office of Inspector General, Department of Labor, and they even get more damage because they report, among other things, that OSHA had promised, David Michaels had promised to make these changes, and he kept none of his promises. And the program was getting worse. Then in the last audit that I reported there, 2015, they actually said, which is kind of unusual for putting in an audit, they don't usually do this, they quoted senior officials in OSHA that ran the program, were responsible for the whistleblower protection program, saying that, well, you know, we're not following the law because nobody's ever held us accountable for not doing it. You know, we take some stuff to court, you know, to federal court or to the administrative law courts, and nobody even raises an issue about us failing to follow the law. So we're just ignoring the law. We're rewriting the law. We're deciding what the program is going to be and isn't. And we've decided this program is going to accommodate. I mean, this is what I basically showed, documented in the second part B. We've decided that we're going to work with the corporations to attack the whistleblowers and destroy them if necessary. And all of the corrupt officials and the other departments, like the Department of Interior, the Department of Navy. You know, I went through Michael's case, CM Lab's case. How could that happen? It can only happen because the United States Senate has collaborated with the corporations to ensure that the major corporations are insulated from accountability for stealing and killing and maiming people. And that's what's going on. And particularly going after, remember Dan Frand, he was part of the FedEx group, Mechanics, and they had the state court case down in Los Angeles that went on for a couple of years about the attack on whistleblowers by FedEx and OSHA. Well, no, OSHA wasn't part of that litigation, but by FedEx. What they found, the 3 years that this case went on through discovery, they have documented that the FAA was collaborating with FedEx, not just to cover up violations of maintenance regulations, but collaborating with FedEx to attack whistleblowers.
So the oversight agency was actually helping the company go after whistleblowers.
Yes. Are we surprised? I'm not surprised.
And even Amazon, with what's happening with health and safety in Amazon.
Yeah, exactly. It's happening with all of these major companies. Amazon, the case, you know, I went through the case that I don't think anybody's really reported on, the case involving Countrywide Financial and the corruption of the real estate residential mortgage market in 2006. 2005. OSHA knew all about it at least a year and a half before the economy collapsed, the global financial economy collapsed because of the fraud in the American residential mortgage market. How many people lost their savings, lost their job, lost their health insurance, probably lost their sanity, among other things, with a great meltdown, the great financial, global financial meltdown could have been prevented by OSHA. Isn't that weird? Collaborating with Countrywide Financial to make sure that case never got to see the light of day. And Yesenia Gutron's case and the other 100 Wells Fargo employees who reported to the Department of Labor and or to OSHA that there's really bad things going on in the consumer fraud with Wells Fargo. And they started reporting it in 2010. Nothing ever happened. Total cover. OSHA spent millions and millions of dollars covering that up for Wells Fargo. Made sure that John Stump, the CEO for Wells Fargo, never had to be accountable for overseeing this massive fraud so he could walk away with a $100 million bonus, golden parachute. I'm sure that happened with others as well.
This is under Eric Holder, Obama's...
This is under Eric Holder, yeah. This is too big to fail, you know, too powerful to jail. The mantra of Eric Holder. Everyone, not just Eric Holder, everyone of the Attorney General of the United States has known about the consumer fraud, the corporate fraud, the attacks on whistleblowers, the systematic corruption of the federal government. Every single attorney general since Eric Holder has known about it and done nothing. And that includes Bill Barr and Jeff Sessions. The Trump administration was as corrupt as the rest of them. It's a bipartisan effort to protect the corporate class.
And the whistleblowers who you yourself are one, but you were investigating their cases, they believed in the system and they were betrayed. Yes. They put their lives in the line.
This is the other part I'm going to try to fill in and shed some light on. Most of the private sector whistleblowers, you know, the Dan Frans and the Mike Madrys and Aaron Stukes, they were making these reports because they knew that they were very dangerous. What was going on with, you know, falsifying asbestos tests, with systematically violating regulations regarding repair and maintenance of aircraft. Good God. And, you know, in Aaron's case, it was the corruption of the system that provides weather information to pilots. Kind of a critical factor if you're going to get up in the air with a plane. Well, what I learned in putting this together, it's always interesting to me to go back and actually look at these cases. Is that the cases I reported, the 15 cases that are in Section B, are all cases that I have reported before, but I didn't sit down and go through them systematically, all the documents, to fully understand why were these cases trashed? Why were the whistleblowers in these cases denied their fundamental due process right to a hearing, to an investigation? And in every single case, what it comes down to is there was a major corporate interest that was threatened by their report. They never knew that. Aaron was just, you know, concerned about all the pilots calling in to get weather briefings, and he didn't have the information necessary to adequately inform them, and he would tell them that, and that's when he got fired. What it turns out was the basic interest that Aaron never saw, and I only saw it a few weeks ago, was that there was an actual Inspector's General report from the FAA that was done in 2007 about Lockheed Martin's management of this program. They took it over as a whole piece from the National Weather Service on a contract, multi-billion dollar contract to provide this weather information service. They were going to be more efficient. They were going to be, you know, and so they consolidated all of these various offices. You know, you have probably six or eight in Northern California alone that provided this kind of service to pilots that the National Weather Service did very adequately for years and years. They consolidated all of these smaller local offices into five regional centers. Of course, it's more efficient. One thing that happens is you sacrifice the quality of the information. And then, of course, they only hired half the people they were supposed to hire to run the program, which meant that when you called in, as Aaron told me on many times, people would call in, they were flying from Florida to Massachusetts, and they're getting ready, they're leaving Florida, they need to have, you know, a weather report for their flight, for the route of their flight, and instead of getting the regional flight people on the East Coast, which would get a single briefing in the morning before they went in to answer all these calls, you're getting massive amounts of calls. So that itself degraded the information. But what would happen would be they would be routed to talk to Aaron in Arizona, who had no idea what the weather was. Aaron tells me he knows at least a couple of cases that those planes crashed and people died.
So it led to deaths, privatization, outsourcing, and corruption by these agencies
the
companies.
Wrong. But what the IG, the FAA IG, in a long report in 2007, condemned the contract and the fact that Lockheed Martin was completely failing the mission. They knew it. They did the audit. They could see it. Lockheed Martin was failing 13 of the 20 measurements for conducting the contract, for meeting the contract requirements. 13 out of 20. If Aaron's case, you see, had gone through the way it should have, in 2010, it would have gone, if OSHA would have reported it to the FAA, this is if things work the way they should, the FAA would have investigated and said, wait a minute, Lockheed Martin has had this contract for almost 5 years and they're still violating the terms of the contract. What would happen under, if we actually had a rules-based government, Lockheed Martin would have been in breach of its contract. It would have suffered massive fines for the breach. The contract would have been taken away from them, given back to the Weather Service. They would have lost the contract. And under the federal contracting system, if you willfully violate federal contracts, you're banned from further federal contracts for a period of years. What is Lockheed Martin in the business of? Its business is to do federal defense contracting, to the level of hundreds of billions of dollars. That's a massive threat. So it's no surprise, that they went after Aaron Stuckey, who's this guy over here in Arizona? We'll just shoot him in the back and leave his body at the side of the road.
That was former federal OSHA whistleblower, protection program lawyer, and investigator Daryl Whitman, interviewed by Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. Find out more about the Diogenes Project, drdarylwhitman.substack.com. That's drdarylwhitman.substack.com.
Playback!
Your heart, cause I know you got a soul. Listen, if you're missing, y'all, swinging while I'm singing. Giving what you're getting, knowing what I'm knowing, while the black band's sweating in the rhythm I'm rolling. Gotta give us what we want, gotta give us what we need. Our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight the powers that be. Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power.
A classic by Public Enemy, Fight the Power. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. The effort to destroy Medicare has been taking place under both Republicans and Democrats, including the Biden administration. WPFW's Thomas O'Rourke interviewed Dr. Anna Molino, a pediatrician and organizer for National Single-Payer Healthcare. She is past president of Physicians for a National Health Program with more than 20,000 health professionals that support a national single-payer health program in the U.S. and is currently a lead organizer for National Single-Payer. She lives in San Francisco. He also interviewed Professor Carol Lang of New York City, who teaches history at the Bronx Community College of the City University of New York and is a member of the American Federation of Teachers Professional Staff Council.
This is Thomas O'Rourke for COVID Race and Democracy. I'm speaking to Anna Molino, MD, who is a pediatrician and organizer for National Single-Payer Healthcare. She is past president of Physicians for a National Health Program with more than 20,000 health professionals that support a national single-payer health program in the U.S. and currently is a lead organizer for National Single Payer. She lives in San Francisco. Professor Carol Lang teaches history at Bronx Community College of the City University of New York. She is a member of the United Front Committee for a Labor Party. Dr. Molino, in your Truth Out article of December 2021, entitled "An Obscure Agency is Threatening to Hand Medicare Over to Wall Street," You describe in alarming terms the gradual but now steady march towards more and more privatization of the Medicare system in this country.
In my article, I outlined the efforts towards the privatization of Medicare really for the past 50 years, practically since its inception in 1965, and the complicity of Congress, which has been repeatedly warned about how much more Medicare costs under private for-profit commercial insurance companies, and yet they have done absolutely nothing to stop this. Now, the question I ask is, why the urgency by the Trump administration first and the Biden administration now to completely privatize Medicare? And the reason, well, really two reasons, I think, is because, one, there is so much popularity among Americans for a national government-funded public health care system that covers everyone, is universal, is comprehensive, is affordable and equitable. And the urgency is that much more intense during pandemic, of course. Now, it is important to your question, for everyone to understand this urgency, even if you're nowhere close to Medicare age. Because if Medicare is totally privatized and taken over by commercial insurance companies, there won't be any Medicare for All left to fight for. Now, I think the profiteers are really worried. And for this reason, we are seeing the wholesale transfer of this public good, Medicare, to private hands, first through Medicare Advantage, and now through this program that we can talk a little bit more about called direct contracting, which inserts a for-profit middleman between Medicare and the doctor and between the doctor and the patient for seniors and people with disabilities on traditional Medicare. These are the people that have rejected Medicare Advantage. They want their Part A and Part B in supplemental plans, and this is all happening without their knowledge or consent. Now, the second reason why there is urgency is because I believe the capitalist class, commercial insurance companies, private equities, and venture capitalists have tapped Americans dry, especially when it comes to health insurance, and are looking for new revenue streams. And Medicare, with its $1 trillion budget, which is the 2020 budget was almost $1 trillion, is the kind of revenue stream that keeps capitalists up at night. So we have these two poles, Americans waking up to a national health program, Medicare for All, and the capitalist class waking up to this realization and to the amount of new money to be made.
And you point out in your article that Medicare Advantage is already been around for quite some time, has been a major part of this sort of privatization scheme of Medicare. What are some of the key problems within Medicare Advantage in terms of greater costs, denial of care, worse health outcomes, and what is your group proposed to do about it?
So you named the major problems with Medicare Advantage, that it costs more. It costs more for Medicare. It's costing more for the beneficiaries, and it is a huge windfall for these commercial insurance companies. But what is happening now and what we're fighting is, if you think of Medicare like a pie, well, one half of it has already been privatized, that's the Medicare Advantage piece. The other half has not been privatized, and that's the piece of the pie that's called traditional Medicare. These are people that have, you know, rejected Medicare Advantage and they just want traditional Medicare. Direct contracting was created in the waning days of the Trump administration and green-lighted by the Biden administration under this little-known agency called the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, also known as the Innovation Center, or the CMMI for short. And the CMMI was created under the Affordable Care Act in 2010, ostensibly to save money and improve care by creating these payment models. And so it has created 50 or so payment models, most of which have failed. And the latest payment model is called direct contracting. And what direct contracting does is it inserts a direct contracting entity, also known as a DCE, or a middleman between Medicare and the doctor and the patient. And never in the history of mankind or womankind has a middleman ever saved money, and it won't in this case either. Now, these middlemen called DCEs, or direct contracting entities, are mostly investor-owned corporations, many publicly traded companies that are supposed to be managing the care of seniors and people with disabilities on Medicare. It's just outrageous, and it is really, really frightening. And to do this, they are not recruiting patients like Medicare Advantage through these endless ads on TV. They are luring primary care doctors, not the patients, the doctors, who, once the doctors sign up, bring their entire panel of patients with them to this new direct contracting entity. So this is happening without the patient's knowledge, without their consent, and without any oversight from Congress, because there's this other little known fact about the CMMI is that they can scale up any model that fulfills its criteria. So as I said, direct contracting is a model, and they can fulfill, they can scale up any model to all of Medicare without any congressional approval. And just to link it to the ACO REACH, we realized at the very beginning when we started hearing about this last year that this was a winnable fight. And trust me, you should never mess with a senior's Medicare. And a delegation from Physicians for National Health Program went to Congress this past November to deliver a petition signed by over 13,000 individuals to Secretary Becerra demanding an end to DCEs. And we were not allowed into the building. We left the petitions there anyway. We have spoken in Congress at briefings and hearings in Congress, who knew little about direct contracting entities, honestly, and they are now waking up as a result of our activism. And so what we did is we forced the CMMI to, quote unquote, end the direct contracting program. But sadly, they replaced it in February with an equally nefarious program called ACO REACH, which is really a rebrand wrapped in equity language. It stands for Accountable Care Organizations Reaching Equity Access and Community Health, everything that it is not. So, yeah, it's basically the same thing, except really it is worse. The idea, of course, is to try to get individuals that are really, really, really healthy into your panel, and that's called cherry picking. But because of the way that Medicare pays the Medicare Advantage plans, it's not directly for services rendered. It's a capitated fee at the beginning of the month, meaning that every patient has this risk score. And for that risk score, Medicare gives that Medicare Advantage plan a certain amount of money every month to do as they wish. And so the idea is to cherry pick the patients, the healthiest patients, but then to make those patients look really, really sick to Medicare so that they get more money for those patients, despite the fact that at the end of the month, they're not giving out any more healthcare services than before. It sounds really complicated, but it really works, and it's called upcoding. And so what ends up happening is that these Medicare plans, and it's been documented, it's been totally documented. And in the past 12 years or so, Medicare Advantage has gained the system by about $140 billion.
Professor Lang, what you've heard the doctor discuss, anything come to mind right now?
Even though I knew, since I've been involved in fighting against the Medicare Advantage program since last year, and I knew a lot of the information that Dr. Melano was just discussing, my blood was starting to boil all over again because, not only is it these wealthy fat cats who want to make, fortunes off the backs of, especially of retirees, but ultimately of everybody, but the trade union bureaucracy has been involved lockstep every step of the way with fooling its members or attempting to fool its retirees into thinking that this is a better deal than Medicare and that we should all go into it. So they negotiated behind our backs for the last 3 years to try to get us to, to pull our strings and get us to join these Medicare Advantage programs. So people are outraged in New York over, all these machinations by their union leaders who are doing this, who stand a lot to gain by, cajoling us and pushing us into things that are going to be incredibly costly and possibly, cause the lives of many people, ultimately, as you heard from Dr. Melano.
How many other unions besides your own is this happening to? Would you say it's across the board in across New York City?
Well, I'm not in the United Federation of Teachers. That's K-12.
My mistake.
I'm in the Professional Staff Congress, which is is a local in the AFT. And I would say that, the Central Labor Council, where the UFT is on DC 37, which is a municipal union, my union, the PSC, the Teamsters, there are 11 unions at least who are on the Central Labor Council, and they've all negotiated behind the backs of the workers. for 3 years they've been negotiating until they made a deal. And then when we found out about it, people, and she's exactly right, you know, you try to mess with Medicare for seniors. I mean, we were out in New York City at, it was 94 degrees, marching around Lower Manhattan, where a lot of the union headquarters are and where City Hall is. And we, I mean, we were out there for hours, and we've been out there on the coldest days also, fighting against, you know, this Medicare Advantage program. You know, they, people who are in their 70s or, you know, 80s, I talked to a number of people on the streets who had cancer any number of times. And those things won't be covered by these Medicare Advantage programs. In fact, it's so terrible that I had hurt my elbow because I fell. And in order to get, I didn't know that I was on a Medicare Advantage program. And as soon as I found out, I immediately switched to Medicare, back to Medicare. In order to get an MRI for my elbow, I had to get an authorization from this Medicare Advantage program. So a lot of people are going to die because these Medicare Advantage programs don't want to give them prior authorization to get x-rays or MRIs or whatever they need in order to find out what's wrong. And so, you know, all that waiting is going to cause death.
Those were the voices of Dr. Anna Molino of Physicians for a National Health Program and a lead organizer for National Single Payer, and Professor Carol Lang with the American Federation of Teachers Professional Staff Council, the City University of New York, and the United Front Committees for a Labor Party. They were interviewed by WPFW's Thomas O'Rourke. For more information on this issue, go to protectmedicare.net.
We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families.
I wanted more pay, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home asbestosis and silicosis, prolonged long lifelong disease, and radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. I wanted more than a paycheck, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home
asbestosis and silicosis for round long black lung disease, and the radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived.
We bring more
than just a little paycheck.
I'm
bringing more than a paycheck. I'm bringing
much
more. You're bringing more than just a little paycheck.
Now workers, listen here, 'cause it's important that you know that whatever we job, there is the fear that disease will take its toll. If not disease, then injury. My Lord, maybe fall or not. And if not injury, then stress is going to tie you up in knots. And so we take home
more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck paycheck to our loved ones and family. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. Bring asbestosis and silicosis around long back lung disease. And the radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived. More than just a little bit of money. More than a paycheck, sweet honey in the rock. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Thousands of public teachers in Oakland who are members of the Oakland Education Association voted by over 70% to hold a one-day strike on April 29th against the closure of 11 schools and privatization of the district. They will be joined by ILWU Local 10 longshore workers who will stop work in solidarity during the day. Later, they will rally at Oscar Grant Plaza or Oakland City Hall to fight against privatization of the schools and the Port of Oakland by billionaire A's and Gap owner John Fisher, who wants a new stadium in the port. East Bay Democratic politicians are also voting to give Fisher a whopping $850 million for his stadium and development project with 3,000 million-dollar condos. The teachers and longshore workers' new organization called Schools in Labor Against Privatization, or SLAP, is hosting the rally, and they will also join the Bay Area May Day March, supported by unions throughout Northern California, that will be held in San Francisco on May 1st. Here are some of their voices.
My name is Max Orozco. I'm a parent of La Escuelita.
My name is Timothy Killens. I switched that to Timothy Akamka. I work at Westlake Middle School as a case manager.
My name is Misty Cross. I'm one of the co-founders of the West Oakland Moms for Housing. I have four children. Three of them have went through public school systems.
My name is Aaron Wright. I'm a longshoreman for the last 32 years, born and raised in Oakland.
School closures in Oakland. The Oakland School Board come up with a list of 16 recommended schools for closure.
There has been a target on all public schools in a lot of different counties.
We have a situation where the billionaire owner of the A's, John Fisher, wants to build housing in our port. And people say, oh no, it's for the A's stadium, but really the goal is housing. And once you put houses in an industrial area, the conflicts are inevitable.
Feelings about the closures, it's gonna hurt the family. Literally all the students and teachers know each other. We take care of each other. Our children take care of their own classmates, which are actually family.
And we've already know the truth, and this is the reason why we're trying to get more parents and more community members on board. There is not a deficit. We do not have a budget issue.
This same entity of John Fisher is trying to close Oakland Public Schools. The same politicians that are trying to take Howard Terminal, privatize it for housing and a baseball stadium.
It's time to get involved now. Our kids need to see us being active. We have to fight for our children until they can fight for themselves.
Join us in the streets. We need to fight this. We're at a crucial time in our history. The United States at large is under stress, and we need to preserve our jobs. We need to preserve jobs in the real economy.
I feel like if we come together across class lines, racial lines, and really have a common goal of like, we want quality education for our kids, public education.
Just because you think that it hasn't hit you yet doesn't mean that it's not coming.
So we need your support, we need your help to fight these closures and keep our teachers in their classrooms.
What we do have is us, we have unity.
You ready to fight? Yeah.
Bye.
Hard Work, another classic by John Handy, recorded in 1976. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. On June 10, 1975, FBI agents Jack Kohler and Ron Williams died in a shootout on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. Leonard Peltier, a member of the American Indian Movement, AIM, spent the last 44 years in prison for charges of aiding and abetting their murders. Peltier's co-defendants were acquitted based on self-defense. To convict Leonard, constitutional violations were committed by the FBI and the U.S. Attorney. Reportedly, they used their governmental resources to get a conviction of Leonard Peltier. Leonard, who is now 77, suffers from diabetes, hypertension, partial blindness from a stroke, and an aneurysm. He had been asking for his COVID booster shot ever since boosters were available. But in January this year, Leonard became ill with COVID. He was finally given a COVID booster shot on February 15th of this year. James Reynolds, the U.S. attorney who was on this case, was asked in an interview, quote, "Did you pick the wrong man?" To which he said, quote, "I don't know." Mr. Reynolds has joined those who lobby for Mr. Peltier's release over the years. Glenn Crooks, who was the lead prosecutor, admitted to the Court of Appeals, quote, "We don't know who shot the agents and what participation Mr. Peltier had, if any. And there's no evidence that he had any role in this except that he was there." From Behind the Lines Radio, here's an interview with Kevin Sharp, Leonard's attorney.
Leonard Peltier, an activist with the American Indian Movement in the 1970s, has been in prison for the past 46 years after he was convicted of killing two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Lakota Sioux Reservation in South Dakota in 1975. The incident occurred during a very violent period of conflict between a corrupt tribal chairman and tribal members who wanted to return to a traditional way of life. Peltier, who is today incarcerated at a federal prison in Florida, was diagnosed with coronavirus in early February. Peltier's trial was rife with prosecutorial misconduct, including perjured testimony that resulted in his extradition from Canada where he had fled, the withholding of exculpatory evidence, and more. Peltier's new attorney, Kevin Sharp, is now asking President Biden for executive clemency. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Sharp, who said he won't know about Peltier's health status until his client is released from quarantine. Here Sharp recounts the worst examples of prosecutorial misconduct, which has kept Leonard Peltier in prison for close to five decades.
The thing that really jumps out at you is withholding the ballistics test that shows it wasn't Mr. Peltier's weapon. And that's the big thing. And if that happened today, the conviction rather is set aside. It's an easy no-brainer question. They get around that by changing their theory. See, I don't think the Court of Appeals would let them get away with that again today either. But you put on top of that the threatened and intimidated witnesses. You don't get an indictment without threatening witnesses. The complete perjury that they suborned with Myrtle Pourbaix. You don't get him out of Canada without that because there's no evidence. You put on top of that that you had a juror who admitted she was prejudiced against Native Americans and she stays on the jury. All of those things, any one of them should have set this verdict aside. All of them together just drive me nuts because it's one of those, why are we still talking about this? In 1977, when this trial took place, you could get away with that. They now have to admit they don't know because the ballistics test that showed it wasn't Leonard came to light. It took years for it to happen, but it came to light. And so now what they say is, but he was there. And so he aided and abetted whoever did this. Which is interesting because his co-defendants were acquitted based on self-defense. So, which means they shot them, but were not guilty of committing murder because it was self-defense. So then the question becomes, who did Leonard Peltier aid and abet? Now, the assistant U.S. attorney says, well, I don't know. This is from an interview with Steve Croft years ago, back in the 90s. Croft asked him that question, and he said, I don't know. Maybe himself. This is ridiculous. We're down some kind of rabbit hole here. What are you talking about? This is gibberish from Alice in Wonderland. It's a legal impossibility. It's a factual impossibility.
Kevin Sharp, at this time, you know, when the struggles of indigenous people have really come to the fore, and when President Biden has specifically said he wants the federal government to build better relationships with them, why is Leonard still in prison?
You know, people call Leonard a political prisoner, and I don't use that term because it means so many different things to different people. But I do say he is a prisoner of politics. He's there because you've got a constituency of the president, in this case, another agency of the federal government, that cannot and will not admit mistakes were made and improper conduct occurred, even though two courts of appeals have said it. They found it, that they threatened and intimidated witnesses. This was a holdover of the Hoover FBI, and this FBI needs to let go of that so that they can break from the Hoover FBI.
I know Leonard has exhausted all his legal appeals. So what's the next step?
He's got a couple of options now. The president of the United States, under his constitutional authority in Article 1 of the Constitution, has the power at any time to grant clemency, either in the form of a pardon or commuting his sentence. And so that's what we're asking for. But there are a couple of other avenues will work, although they don't set him free. The Bureau of Prisons has the ability to request compassionate release. They can't do it. They can request it. He fits the criteria for that because of his age and his health. It makes no statement at all about whether anybody committed the crime and their sentence was. It just says, because of these things, we are asking the court, as the Bureau of Prisons, to commute his sentence. The other thing they can do is they can grant to serve his sentence as home confinement as part of the COVID release. So the Attorney General sent a message to the Bureau of Prisons that says, look, this pandemic is bad. It's worse inside prison. The death rate is three times higher for incarcerated individuals who catch COVID. And so the Attorney General said, go through your population. And for those people who are particularly at risk, for whom it's safe to do that, let them serve their remaining sentence at home. And so some have been released to home confinement, not many, not nearly enough, but they could do that with Leonard as well. He would go home, wear an ankle bracelet, and serve his time at home. His only real opportunity is for the president to recognize what happened here, recognize the injustice that took place, put the Constitution of the United States ahead of your own political welfare and concern.
Thanks to Behind the Lines for this presentation of Kevin Sharp, Leonard Peltier's attorney. Leonard Peltier is serving two life sentences in Coleman Maximum Security Prison in Florida. Learn more about this story at the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee website, whoisleonardpeltier.info. We thank producer Jacqueline Baptiste of KPFT Houston for filing this report.
You know you a down ass warrior. United States government is doing you wrong, but the movement has proved it's to the U.S. all along. The hidden documents that can free you from your cell. I pray someday you walk out of your living hell. They took most of your life, dirty long knives. To you I fly this kind to let you know I feel your strife. Clinton cheats on his wife, he had no alibi. Promised you a pardon, but they were all white lies. But he gave one to his brother-in-law, that crooked-ass bastard. A new millennium and we still slaves to the masters. Peltier did 30 years, denied parole. Denied a fair trial, that's just the way it goes. But the beat goes on from my ancestral drums. war Peyton AKs, devils, here we come. We'll never bow down, Mr. Bush will call you majesty. Pale tears, a political prisoner, we demand amnesty and immunity from all my native community. Together we stand, divided we fall, we need unity. The struggle continues, never forget Wounded Knee. In 1890, Ogallala, 1973, two of yours were killed compared to our millions. Your own damn people blown up government buildings. People live in glass houses, shouldn't throw stones. Pale tear, my brother, man, you are not alone. Doing time for a crime that you didn't commit. The government is guilty of more than that. Murder one, theft, false imprisonment and rape. Trespassing, strong arm, robbery and hate. Kidnapping, slavery and other hate crimes. You think I hate your people just because you hate mine? People like to play. There's a native on my flay, had my medicine bag, riding shotgun with Leonard and my warrior syndicate. Going to pick up his check for the wrongful imprisonment. It's a damn shame, isn't it? The justice is filthy. Where's the burden of proof innocent until proven guilty? Where is all the evidence? Release the hidden documents. You sink on this land with the only true occupants.
Beat Goes on Peltier by Buggy Malone with Kevin Smith, from the album Spirit World. Hundreds of Amazon worker supporters rallied in New York City on Sunday. AFA President Sarah Nelson, along with Senator Bernie Sanders on Sunday, joined a rally in solidarity with the Staten Island Amazon workers. Here is a short clip from Sarah Nelson. Concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by executive producers of CRD, Akua Holt, Paulina Fasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. You can also follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.